sitting here with Roger Farr and our guests tonight, Rita Wong and Clint Burnham. I think we're going to begin with a piece of music.
Well, I had something different scheduled tonight, but by request of Rita, I'm going to play a DOA from War on 45.
Poetic Device. We're on the air now a little bit late tonight. We were at the evening news discussion here at Vivo. All of our guests too. So we may bring something up from that. Who knows? But I think we're going to begin with Rita Wong reading something, saying something, and we'll have a bit of discussion. So Rita Wong, a Vancouver poet and educator, an activist. Wonderful to have her here.
Thanks, Steve. Grievances in no particular order. The largest military presence seen in Western Canada since the end of the Second World War. 15,000 police, soldiers, and private security guards will be deployed and will sleep and eat in three rented cruise ships. $9 million worth of cops and more than 1,000 security cameras added to the 2,000 that are already there in place. Spending money on spectacle instead of schools. Canceling 2,400 surgeries, laying off 233 government employees, 800 teachers, and recommending the closure of 14 schools. Using capital to co-opt sportsmanship. Athletes turned into advertisements. Trucking snow nearly 2 hours from Allison Pass, which is about 150 kilometers east of Vancouver, to Cypress Mountain. The earth asks us to slow down, and her language is wiser and more generous than the dialect of money, capital, cops. Disconnection from natural cycles will be the death of us. Climate change calls out a warning. Are we smart enough to respond? Save that snow for the bears up north who need it to survive. All this waste, prioritizing the wrong things, makes me sick. So there's some quotes in that from a few articles in The Guardian and from Reuters. And this was written before the Olympics. And so since the Olympics. Helicopters patrol downtown Vancouver from morning to night. At first I can only hear them, but as I keep looking up, I spot at least three of them hovering noisily above. I'm sure their rationale is traffic monitoring, but the subtext feels like military surveillance, especially with $1 billion worth of security in the city and cops everywhere being put up on cruise ships in the harbor. What is the carbon footprint of those three helicopters flying over Vancouver day and night during the Olympics? What is the carbon footprint of destroying Eagle Ridge Bluffs and the Larson Creek wetlands in order to straighten and widen the Sea to Sky Highway? How many of the thousands of tourists visiting Vancouver hear about the death of Squamish elder Harriet Mahaney? She was jailed for 2 weeks for disobeying a BC Supreme Court injunction ordering protesters to stay away from the Eagle Ridge Bluffs. She died at the age of 71 from pneumonia, complicated by lung cancer and exacerbated by being imprisoned. According to Diane Srivastava, the multi-lane highway disrupts important dispersal processes for wildlife populations, so there will probably be a long but inevitable walk to local extinction for those species. That's from an article called Highway of Good Intentions from Scientific American. What is the relationship of the part to the whole? When calculating the ecological footprint of the Olympics, do we count the impact of sponsors like RBC, which financed the tar sands devastation in northern Alberta? Of Coca-Cola, which has been depleting the groundwater of communities in India? Anne Hansen, quote, remaining passive in the face of today's global human and environmental destruction will create deeper scars than those resulting from the mistakes we will inevitably make by taking action. That's from Direct Action. Who, where, when, why, and how? Perhaps the funniest story arising from the Olympics was the suggestion that Norway was not doing as well in the games as expected because they may have been hexed by BC Indian chiefs. Quote, several BC chiefs did stage a 29-hour hunger strike that week to protest the 29 Norwegian-owned fish farms in the Musgamag Tsotwatanuk Tribal Council's territories in the Broughton Archipelago north of Vancouver. Marine Harvest and Cermaq, which own the fish farms, both have Norwegian parent companies. The 29-hour hunger strike was timed to end on Tuesday, just before the start of the Olympic hockey game between Canada and Norway, which Canada won 8-0. One of the hunger strikers was Chief Bob Chamberlain from Guilford Island near Port McNeill, who denied having any mystic influence at the Olympics. I can honestly report that I do not possess this kind of spiritual power, Chamberlain said. If I did possess such a power, I don't think I would be directing it at the Norwegian national sportsmen. I think I would direct it towards the fish farms. When the Lubicon First Nation protested at the 1988 Winter Olympics in Calgary, this was how I first learned that Shell was destroying their homelands. More than 20 years later, over 1,700 oil and gas wells plus countless pipelines have been forced upon their traditional territories. And the Lubicon are still fighting for their land to be treated with respect. None of us wanted the Olympics, but now they are here. How do we best use them to educate people who might not otherwise hear about important struggles, be they those of the Lubicon, or the homeless in the downtown east side, or the many who oppose salmon farms along BC's coast? The tent village in the downtown east side is one of the most inspiring examples of grassroots organizing I have had the honor to witness. It gives me hope for human ecology, and the challenge is to keep holding governments and corporations responsible for social housing long after the Olympic occupation concludes. Social housing matters, and so do the nesting areas for bald eagles like Eagle Ridge Bluffs and the straits and rivers that we and the salmon need in order to survive. It's not easy to constantly remind people of what they'd rather forget, that the party comes with a heavy price. I don't begrudge people whatever small pleasures they can gain for living life fully. I do, however, find the appropriation and colonization of human energy toward corporate agendas abhorrent. It's not so easy to draw those lines, but they do slide in and out around us. Bruce Alexander, author of The Globalization of Addiction, has suggested that there's a difference between exuberance and insatiability. Exuberance is what you see when children want to play too much. They want to go out and have a good time, and so they should. This is healthy. Insatiability is what you see with addictions that are harmful. They also involve excess, but they feel more desperate than joyful. It's easy to confuse the two when talking about the Olympics, but underneath the flashy exuberance, the spectacle, there's also the corporate insatiability at work, machine-like and earth-destroying, which you cannot unsee once you've seen it.
Thanks a lot, Rita. One thing I'm interested in and curious about in that first piece you read about the grievances is a sense of picking up the noise that's in the air right now, language that's being used in the streets, in the media. And I'm curious about that. I think as poets, maybe we always do that at some level. But I wonder if there's a heightened sense of doing that now during the Olympics, now while many of us are uber conscious of the message out there and struggling with what's going on. But if you had any comments about that as a practice and a tactic, picking up the noise and feeding it back.
Yeah, I think it's a struggle, right? Like, it's an ongoing process. Harjap was talking earlier tonight about the term green, for instance, and these so-called green games. And it's hard to know when to hang on to the language and try to, like, appropriate it and use it, and when to just give up and say, I'm not going to use that word anymore because it's been so abused that it no longer has any use, which he was arguing about green. And, I mean, these so-called green games, they're anything but, I think, mm-hmm. when we look at the whole picture. So I guess I think just paying attention to the noise and trying to recontextualize it in mm-hmm. little ways, right? It feels like you're in this situation where you're always being bombarded with too much information. Or I do, anyway. I feel like there's just too much coming at me.
Yeah.
And so I'm just kind of like chewing on it and sifting on it and trying to find out little bits and pieces that maybe I can build from or work with.
Just to follow up on that, Rita, I'm sorry to have my back turned, but Laura Elrich was in town recently, and as you may know, her piece Stock, which was written in response to Guantanamo Bay, she had said something to me I thought was really interesting, which was that, you know, that she said living in New York and being so completely saturated in signs within the space of the city, but I imagine also, you know, New York is probably in some ways a lot like Vancouver, is a highly cramped discursive space, especially for poets. And she said that, you know, she felt that she wanted to kind of move away from she felt some distrust. I'm not sure if I'm paraphrasing her correctly, but that she felt some distrust or inefficacy in using poetry to intervene politically, and that it was increasingly mm-hmm. important for her to bring her body into the into semiotic space, I guess. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering, this is something we've come back to, we've talked about quite a bit in the last few shows. Where do you think your writing or writing, where do you think it might actually interfere with capitalist accumulation, with colonization, you know, taking root in our communities? Like, where do you think writing lodges itself in that struggle?
Mm, that's a great question. Well, first I want to say that writing is not enough, right? That actions are needed, and like Dave was saying today, Dave Dewitt, about occupying space is really important. I totally agree with that. But I think we have to look at what tools or what skills we have and try to use them to the best of our abilities. So in terms of language, like, or poetry, it's kind of perhaps naive of me, but like, for example, when it gets taught in the classroom, right, there's I think some possibility of breaking open or little ruptures or fragments of things kind of bubbling to the surface if you have a good teacher and if you have, you know, a receptive student. But there's all these things that are out of your control. Mm-hmm. And, or I shouldn't say receptive, but like perceptive. And but you just kind of put things out there and hope that they kind of end up where they need to go, I feel like. So, yeah, I mean, that's one space, but certainly not the only space. I mean, that's a very institutionalized space, too.
Well, yeah.
But also, I think poets writing to each other. Harjap said something about quality versus quantity, and I think that that's important that dialogue continue, even if sometimes we want to see it stretch larger or, you know, it feels like we need to grow faster or whatever, that thread continues as well.
Well, it's interesting because one of the, you know, one of the claims that a lot of contemporary poetry and poetic makes, especially in regards to formal intervention, is that still a lot of the time draws on these notions like defamiliarization and shock and making language strange and confronting the reader and altering perception. But I'm noticing in your work and in other peers' writing, a use of language that seems more productive than relying on the avant-garde strategies of negation, per se. And in particular, in your writing, the poems to me often seem like really material sites of rearticulation between different social movements and different kinds of political positions, temporary kind of position takings, and that the site becomes kind of the poem becomes a site of like a nexus of these different movements. Is that
and an intervention too? I think in certain dialogues and discourses.
Yeah.
I think there's something to be said for bringing along together discourses that aren't normally seen as being conversation, but they are. You know what I mean? Like, so that's important. I think. Defamiliarization, Austrianini, and that is great. I have nothing against it. I think it's a question of what tactics you use when. Mm. That's all.
Yeah, and I find the more desperate times feel or seem to me, the more I tend to move away from a defamiliarized or unreadable position and speak in a quote, more clear and direct voice, the more I feel distraught and the more tenuous things feel. Although I'm really glad we talked about the body here and doing more than just writing. I guess I sometimes beat myself up. You know, I'm most of what I write is
Steve. Quote, the police are supposed to do that for you.
I know, but I'm trying to help the cops out. most of what I write is quote political in some way or another. But I realized recently I can't put that much pressure on poor old poetry to carry the burden of all my political activity.
Yeah.
It's just not strong enough to bear that burden, and I need to go out there and do other things too. And so I don't know. Do you feel that sometimes that it's not a weakness of poetry, but it's just you know, it's not enough just to write poetry, even though we may be for any number of reasons given to write poems. More than do other certain things.
I think it depends on the poet. I think it depends on the person. I'm not here to judge anybody else for with the choices they make or don't make.
Oh, come on.
I will.
Let's judge some people. We've been doing that a lot.
You know, we're fragile.
What about
creatures.
Shane Coizan?
No, don't go there.
We've done that.
Yeah. But I just know for myself when I feel that urgency that it's important that word be linked to action. And truth be told, like if I look back at my history, like I think I started, you know, very reclusive writing, and it was the writing that kind of led me to things I had to do. It was word that led me to action, and still does in a way.
That's nice.
It's slow, right? It's very slow. It's painstakingly too slow. But
yeah, I agree.
That's all I have.
Yeah.
I've got this passage, a quote from Rancière, who I know a lot of people are sort of sick of because he seems so imminently...
I like Rancière.
Yeah, but he's so quotable, you know? It's like... it's that Nietzschean trajectory, but there's a good line in here, a passage from Politics of Aesthetics, where he says, "The arts only ever lend to projects of domination or emancipation what they are able to lend to them, what they have in common with them, bodily positions and movements, functions of speech, the parceling out of the visible and the invisible." And this is the part that I think is really interesting. He says, "It is up to the various forms of politics to appropriate for their own proper use the modes of presentation or the means of establishing explanatory sequences produced by artistic practices rather than the other way around." And I like that passage because in a way it kind of turns the question more into, you know, how do artistic practices, including poetry, cultural practices, how do they make their methods of presentation, their modes of presentation, available to movements? And so it's not so much a question of writers appropriating political positions or political ideologies insofar as making certain modes of organization, certain modes of presentation available to social movements. So that's kind of a nice way of turning that question around.
Absolutely, yeah. We've been nibbling around the edge of that issue quite a bit, I guess, on these shows so far. That you know, what's the politics of poetic form, or Ranciere's title, the aesthetics of politics. Where do these two things meet? And maybe that connects to what we were just saying. Are there certain situations politically where we're drawn to write in a certain way, and when the political situation is different, we may write differently.
And it's not like there's only one way to write. I mean, we might be writing many different ways,
exactly.
You know, at the same time, or close to the same time, too.
Mm-hmm. I like the term you used a little bit earlier, Rita, about recontextualizing, I think you said. Recontextualizing some of these found bits and pieces we pick up, and I think that's important.
I feel like I've done my share of readings where I have to spend more time actually explaining the whole context of the poem than the actual poem itself. You know, like that might be over in a minute, and I'll spend like today, like I talked quite a bit about, you know, the electricity destroying First Nations land and the water and that whole thing, like just to sort of try to see things differently, like everyday things, right?
Exactly. And I thought that was actually very effective, that moment when earlier tonight at Vivo, where you said about the WAC Bennett Dam and how that displaced I can't remember which, but
Sikene people.
The Sikene?
Yeah.
And so that basically every time you flick on a light, you can be reminded of colonization, essentially, or the expropriation of land, or there's a number of ways we could approach that exact situation.
And I think that's not about, like, making us feel bad when we turn on the lights, but it's, like, a reminder and a question that what are you going to do about it? Like, how are you going to respond, right?
Yeah.
Mm. It could be read as an invitation rather than just a guilt trip.
Yeah, I think the again, going back to that first piece of grievances you read, when we are picking up these things or grabbing these things out of the air, these sound bites and these things that are going on, and recontextualizing them, in some ways that's exactly what we're doing, aren't we? I wonder, Roger, if we could play a song here, and when we come back, have Clint read us something.
Okay. Well, as our listeners, I'm getting Judas Priest requests, but as our listeners in Vancouver know, there's been a lot of talk about tactics in Vancouver in the last week or so. And, you know, like it or not, I think it needs to be said that the question of tactics has arisen largely because of the heart attack demo on Saturday the 13th. In which some bank windows got smashed up and the Hudson's Bay windows got smashed up. Boo-hoo. And so there's been a lot of sort of wringing of hands and spilling of ink about these tactics. So I'm going to play a couple of songs tonight that deal with the question of tactics. And the first one is from the Fugees, and this is The Mask.
Have you ever worn the mask? Yeah. 1 2 1 2.
M to the A to the S to the K. Put the mask on the face just to make it next day. Feds be hawking me, jokers be stalking me. I walk the street and camouflage my identity.
Posse in a Brooklyn wear the mask. My crew in a Jersey wear the mask. Pick up kids doing boogie woogie wear the mask.
Yeah, everybody wear the mask. Yeah. But how long will
it last? I used to work at Burger King, a king taking orders. Punching my clock, now I'm wanted by the manager. Souping me up, saying,
you're a good worker. How would you like a quarter raise? Move up to the register. Large in charge, but you gotta be a spy. Come back and tell me who's bagging my fries. Getting high on company time.
Hell no, sirree. Wrong MC. Why should I be a spy when you're spying me? And you
see what you thought you saw but never seen. You missed the last move, checkmate, crown me king. Pull my 22 pistol, whip them in his face. Higher, now I'm fired, sober, now I'm wired. Eyes pitch red, but the beat bop my head hit the streets for relief. I bumped into feds, I got kidnapped, they took me to D.C. Had me working underground, building missiles for World War III.
M to the A, to the S, to the K, put the mask on my face just to make it next day. Brothers be gaming, ladies be claiming. I walk the street and camouflage my identity.
My posse uptown wear the mask. My crew in the Queens wear the mask. Pick up kids with the Tommy Hill wear the mask.
Yeah, everybody wear the mask, but how long will it last? I thought he was the one done. I was stung on by his lips. Taking sips of an amaretto sour with a twist. Shook my hips to the baseline. This joker grabbed my waist, putting pressure on my spine, trying to get elbow to wine. I backed the ball from then I caught him. With 5 fingers to his face. I had to put him in his place. This kid's invaded my space. But then I recognized the smile, but I couldn't place the style. So many fronts in his mouth. I thought he was the golden child. Then it hit me, that's the freak from off the street around my grand. I haven't seen him since 15 when he got booked for doing scams. I tried to walk away, but he wouldn't let me leave. He ran him quick behind me asking, yo, what happened to my nigga Steve? Steve was like this kid I went with back in grammar school. I chuckled, knucklehead, I seen him yesterday. He's busted, so who you checking for now? Probably some intellectual. I kept the conversation straight, but he kept trying to make it sexual. Then his old lady tried to play me, waved her hands up in my face. Yo, I told her, check your man, cause bitch, you acting out of place.
M to the A, to the S, to the K, put the mask on my face just to make it next day. Brothers be front, then they be running. I walk the street and camouflage my identity.
My posse in the Bronx wear the mask. My crew on the aisle wear the mask. Stick up kids rolling in the Omni wear the mask.
Yeah, everybody wears a mask, but how long will it last?
3 a.m. in the morning, on the boulevard, I'm still at large, engaged with my entourage. Me and Godfather in the 67 Dodge. I stepped out and looked, then posted up my guard. Searching for my car that was stolen from Scotland Yard. My first instinct was to check the chop shop garage. As I rung the bell, someone tapped me on my back. I turned around and looked, it was a rookie in the mask. He said, I got an itch on my trigger. Don't move, nigga, I'm taking you for murder. See, cops are two faces like two laces on my Reebok. My knees knock as I step back for a clear shot.
Yo, did you shoot him?
Nah, kid, I didn't have the balls. That's when I realized I'm bumping too much Biggie Smalls.
M to the A, to the S, to the K. Put the mask on your face just to make the next day. Runners be beefing, cops be beefing, brothers be scheming. It should be teaming. Jokers be smoking and staying broken. Bitches be teasing and money squeezing. Niggas be creeping, baby mothers be weeping. I walk the street and camouflage my identity.
My posse in the Haiti wear the mask. My crew in Jamaica wear the mask. Pick up kids bumping Fuji La wear the mask.
Yeah, everybody wear the mask, but how long will it last? Said.
We're back.
More short-range poetic device with a very short range tonight, but that's all right. This is being recorded for posterity.
We've moved the mics around. We have a diversity of mic tactics in the room.
Exactly. It's important. Now, our next up, we have Clint Burnham, who's going to read us something.
Is this the Clint Burnham?
It's the Clint Burnham. I know there are several, but it's the one and only.
There's another one. There's another one, apparently. This is called No Poems on Stolen Land. It's for my sister Teresa. I'd like to acknowledge that we are on stolen land. I'd like to acknowledge that we are on borrowed land. I'd like to acknowledge that we are on overdue land. I'd like to acknowledge that we are on pickpocketed land. I'd like to acknowledge that we are on empty land. I'd like to acknowledge that we are on full land. I'd like to acknowledge the knowledge of like to acknowledge you like me acknowledging. I'd like to acknowledge that we are trespassing on someone else's property if that someone else had a property, and if we are who we think we are and not, in fact, perhaps also someone else's acknowledgement. I'd like to acknowledge I meant that. I'd like to acknowledge I meant to say that we are on land that was empty when my grandfather moved here in what was it, 1948? I'd like to acknowledge that my grandfather moved here in what was it, 1948, and then went back to Winnipeg and then came out again with my grandmother and my dad. And I'd like to acknowledge I always hate it when I see the little items on maps saying IR number 30. But I also like seeing IR number 30, and it's usually in italics for some reason, because they acknowledge how their little space is marked IR number 30, both part of the cities of human habitation which are on the maps and the landscape, the time immemorial, blah, blah. I'd like to acknowledge my Dene sister. I'd like to acknowledge my Gitxsan brother. I'd like to acknowledge my Tsleil-Waututh cousin. I'd like to acknowledge my Nakunath mother-in-law. I'd like to acknowledge my Squamish daughter. I'd like to acknowledge my Okanagan boyfriend. I'd like to acknowledge we are getting into dangerous territory here. I'd like to acknowledge 5 minutes of colonialism. I'd like to acknowledge 50 pages of post-colonial bibliography. I'd like to acknowledge the virtual res. I'd like to acknowledge the suburban res. I'd like to acknowledge the low-res res. I'd like to acknowledge the talking memory stick. I'd like to acknowledge acknowledging. I'd like to acknowledge the brass mask my uncle made at reform school in the 1960s on Vancouver Island. I'd like to acknowledge the hot chocolate I had on army maneuvers on Skokale Land in July 1980. I'd like to acknowledge both I can't acknowledge and I'd like to acknowledge Oka. I'd like to acknowledge 518 years, 4 months, 12 days, 7 hours, etc. of resistance. I'd like to acknowledge 10,000 years of resistance. I'd like to acknowledge the Freudian notion of resistance. I'd like to acknowledge British colonialism. I'd like to acknowledge Canadian colonialism. I'd like to acknowledge Musqueam colonialism. I'd like to acknowledge Roman colonialism. I'd like to acknowledge Norman colonialism. I'd like to acknowledge Persian colonialism. I'd like to acknowledge Franco, Prussian, Sino, Nippo, Indo, Afro, Turco, Islamo, Togo, Pogo, Hawaiian, Espresso, anyone who thought they could grab something imperialism. I'd like to acknowledge cultural relativist imperialism. I'd like to acknowledge academic colonialism. I'd like to acknowledge activist colonialism. I'd like to acknowledge that we are on bureaucratic land. I'd like to acknowledge poetic colonialism. I'd like to acknowledge drinking a glass of water 10 minutes ago and not having to boil the water first. I'd like to acknowledge the ice on the inside of the walls when I lived in Labrador in the 1970s as part of the military occupation of Inuit Indian land. I'd like to acknowledge not having mold in my son's room. I'd like to acknowledge hearing Elizabeth Gowdy talk about her autobiography and working trap lines in the 40s in Labrador in 1974. I'd like to acknowledge we are on stolen Stolo land. I'd like to acknowledge we are on messed up Musqueam land. I'd like to acknowledge we are on crappy Comox land. I'd like to acknowledge we are on sexually harassed Six Nations land. I'd like to acknowledge we are on fucked up Beothuk land. I'd like to acknowledge we are on incestuous Inuit land. I'd like to acknowledge the triangles in the script and the toboggans in the script in the phone book in Goose Bay. I'd like to acknowledge the Ookpik Figure Skating Club. I'd like to point out that we are the ones doing the acknowledging, so you should give us a break. I'd like to acknowledge we're doing a lot more besides and could be doing a lot more besides. I'd like to acknowledge corruption in the hereditary chiefs and band councils. I'd like to acknowledge corruption in the Department of Indian Affairs. I'd like to acknowledge my word processing program just capitalized the I in Indian just now, and it did it again. I'd like to acknowledge corruption in the university. I'd like to acknowledge corruption in the art world. I'd like to acknowledge I was paid to say that, to write that. I'd like to acknowledge the $750 I got from Vanock, and the check for which is in my wallet right now, about 12 inches from the words, about 12 inches, that I just wrote in my notebook. I'd like to acknowledge I didn't measure that. It's just an estimate. I'd like to acknowledge that what I like about what I like to acknowledge is that it's about me, a sensitive liberal, a tough but sensitive radical, looking good, new t-shirt. Do you like these jeans? They were on sale. Are they too tight? They were when I bought them, but now I need a belt. Am I too old to wear this shit now? And what I'd like to acknowledge is that I don't like it if I drink too much. I'd like to acknowledge I was sober for 4 years and I'm not now. I mean, I'm not drunk right now, but I have the occasional drink, or maybe more than the occasional drink. But I like to acknowledge that I don't like it when someone reads a poem about getting drunk or getting cleaned up, and they've got the details about puking on their tits or that blinding feeling in their head when they're suffering the morning after. And I like to acknowledge it's getting way too personal, even for me. So I'd like to get back to acknowledging we are on stolen, native, indigenous, Indian, Injun, Eskimo, Chug, Métis, First Nations, half-breed land. We're on native land, on native carpet, on native subflooring, on native weeping foundation, on native weeping tiles, on native tarmac, on native sidewalk, on native dirt, on native leaf mold, the good mold, on native mud in our backyard, on native holes in the ground where our fence was ripped up by the landlord. Not the landlord. Guys working for a guy working for the landlord. Maybe they were native. I don't know. I didn't ask them. We're on native highway of tears, on native land, on home and native land, and I like to acknowledge the acknowledging that we are on stolen, ripped off, colonized, unceded, conquered, begged, borrowed, stolen native land. Doesn't do a damn bit of motherfucking difference, and I'd just like to acknowledge that.
Whoa.
Thanks, Clint.
Thanks a lot. Okay, Clint, we should hear your version, or some commentary on that. At some level, you're talking about, my interpretation, the wearing out of a certain phrasing, the gesture or the convention, if you want to call it that, of acknowledging our presence on unceded native land that we often come across in literary and cultural events in Vancouver. But what's your take on that?
Yeah,
your poem can be read as a critique of that. Obviously,
yeah,
of the phrase.
I think it is. I mean, and you know, to use that word being thrown around dialectically, hopefully that on the one hand it is this empty thing, this empty gesture, and I mean, the harshest critique would be it's just to make us feel better because we're saying this thing. So we say this thing, and that means, you know, what Hegel called our beautiful soul. I'm this beautiful, sensitive, liberal person, and I'm acknowledging.
Yeah, you're sensitive, radical, in the skinny jeans.
Yeah, but I mean. And so I could go further with that, but then the other side of it too is, and you know, and I mean, we had there's discussions going on for a while, and certainly in terms of how I've been thinking about it actively for the past year and a half, going back to stuff that Reg Johansen and Rita Wong were talking about at the positions conference at the KSW colloquium, in this very building, in the summer of 2008, and in which, you know, there was different positions, and one of the things that I think Rita had said was how Gordon Campbell at one point did some kind of acknowledging or mentioning, not saying unceded Coast Salish, but saying we were on Coast Salish land for this thing he did at Emily Carr. But on the other hand, empty gestures are still necessary. We still have to do, it's not like it's not doing anything, you know, it's not changing history, doesn't mean you don't do it. I mean, when you go to someone's house, they'll say thank you and so on, right? Mm. And courtesies are very important. They're not just bourgeois conventions. They're very important things to do. So I guess I'm on both sides of it there.
I was going to ask Clint about if we can talk about the I'd like to acknowledge XYZ as a speech act.
That's
and what it communicates other than its content. Because in a way, I was thinking of when you were reading that piece. I was thinking of Dan Farrell's "A Veil" from Last Instance. You know, I'm really concerned about my physical health. I feel angry when I think about my physical health. I haven't been feeling angry. I'm hostile when I feel. You know, it goes on and over time, he kind of empties out the subject position from which those utterances are made. And so you're just left with them as purely rhetorical acts, pure speech acts. And I'm curious about what you think about that utterance, the acknowledgement utterance as a speech act. Once its content is removed, what else it communicates about the speaker and the situation?
Yeah, I mean that beautiful soul thing again. That kind of. It's like it establishes you as the person making that gesture, making that kind of acknowledgement. And I think that's partly why the two things that I found myself doing when I was writing it, on the one hand, was playing with acknowledging and playing, you know, making the sentences more difficult to sort of for me to read out loud, because trying to figure out the rhythm and the grammar. But also it became super self-indulgent, right? And so, I mean, I for one thing, I wanted to throw in things about thinking about when I was in the Army in 1980 around Chilliwack, or when I was living in Labrador in the 70s and so on, right? And those kind of things. And but so trying to push throw, but even when you throw in autobiographical stuff, it still becomes this empty speech act in a certain kind of way, right? It just becomes, you know, those autobiographies have genres, and they talk about people going through a bad time and then somehow emerging better at the end of it. And that's why we read autobiographies for Frederick Douglass getting away and becoming free, or somebody quitting alcohol or whatever that is. But getting back to the speech act of acknowledging itself, and yet even as it's, you know, maybe you want to talk about this in terms of what you do about protest genres and that, it doesn't mean we don't do it. I mean, even though there's still genres, even though it's this empty kind of thing. And, you know, when I heard Chris Bowes, this First Nations poet from in the Okanagan, and I wrote this when I was in the Okanagan. Is it
Kamloops?
Oh, yeah. In Kamloops. I was in Kelowna when I heard him read and stuff, right? And he talked about being in a slightly different territory at that point, right? And so, like, the way in which the territories themselves are overlapping, not, you know, in the way of sort of like the Eurocentric model of borders being discrete kind of thing, right? But he was also talking about that, right? And then throwing in the names as well, and actually, can anyone here pronounce the name of my nation, right? You know, and he's, you know, no one could. And, yeah. And so trying to, I like trying to put those words in there, trying to pronounce them, and as a both a respect thing, but also just as a poet, because they're interesting words and interesting spellings, and, you know, there's a seven in the middle of the word Squamish, right? You know, I mean, it's, it's so cool that's there.
Yeah, I mean, that's the kind of the interesting thing about that piece, Glenn, is that, you know, while you're there's sort of a critique of the speech act or the potential hollowness of acknowledging what often the room you're acknowledging that to, everyone already does acknowledge that, but maybe people outside that room don't. Nevertheless, you take that acknowledgement to the extreme that we could if we actually really wanted to do this in our lives and go back over our whole history and where have I been? Whose land have I been on? Every moment of you've lived, you can acknowledge some dependence, some trespass, some precedence of someone else. You know, maybe we'd go crazy if we did that in every second and every moment. But the, like you say, the gesture itself is pretty powerful, I think, when you take it to that extreme.
Yeah, and I mean, Earnhardt had this thing a couple of years ago, I think when she was talking at the Roy Mickey thing, when she said, you know, if I was here 200 years ago, I would have probably been a slave or something, right? Because, you know, she's from, like, Manitoba, right? If a Manitoba person had ended up, an Anishinaabe from Manitoba had ended up in Coast Salish territory, the reason would have been not a very good one, sort of thing, right? Yeah. So not that it's great now with colonialism because I can come here, but just not to romanticize a notion of First Nations people. You know, there's really kind of which we hear a lot, not only on the left, because obviously it's the avatar world as well. It's the corporate right, right? That romanticization of a harmony and so on. Yeah. But it's as disrespectful as negative stereotypes. Were you gonna?
I just wanted to say, in terms of the speech act, like, I think whether or not it's a hollow gesture, the question is what else accompanies it in terms of actions, right? That's the thing that is burning in my mind when I hear it. And then, this is sort of an aside, but Avatar, have you guys seen this video on YouTube of these Palestinians appropriating
Avatar?
It's kind of amazing.
And horrific in a way, because, you know, you sort of, there's a weird line between fiction or performance and actual, you know, they're being gassed, in their Avatar costumes. Pretty amazing.
One of the things that I find with that, just to come back to the question of the acknowledgement as a speech act, is that my experience of that when I hear people acknowledge that, like tonight, I think Harjap was the only speaker who acknowledged his
which he did in a nice kind of variant of it. He didn't do sort of the rote same version. Yeah. He just sort of did his own sort of ad lib version, which was nice.
One of the things the way I kind of feel, the way I interpret that or read that is really as an expression of a solidarity and as also a kind of flagging of everything that follows as being linked to, that the person is telling me that they are invested in and have ties to anti-colonial struggle. And so in a way it functions as a, for me, as a frame.
Yeah.
And that I find really interesting because it sets up a kind of a frame and a way of listening to what I hear afterwards. And in the context of poetry, like that's quite different than someone, you know, who's giving kind of a public talk or a presentation and it is going to sort of develop ideas of anti-colonial resistance or indigenous struggles. But when I hear it before poetry, it kind of it reframes and
too sucky. You're saying it's too sucky?
No. Not that it's sucky. That it's like an interpretive. It helps me to hear. It's like it flags. It changes the way I actually interpret the sounds literally, and the way I receive the words.
Yeah.
I jump in with a specificity. I mean, where we are right now on Main, just off of Main Street, just over 100 years ago, actually it was underwater. False Creek went all the way to, I think, Clark.
Yeah.
And that's hole and bottom. You know, there's different words that Krista Kiakos has in his photographs and using Coast Salish words for what this area was called and so on, right? So there's that, yeah, it was like we're underwater. You know, getting down to a territory of a specific, you know, square footage kind of thing as well. I just wanted to throw that.
Yeah, nice.
Broadcasting from underwater.
Yeah, exactly. Here we are. I'm thinking about protest genres and tactics and diversity of tactics. And, you know, when we do see a protest genre we recognize or a tactic we recognize and go, oh, yeah, that one, I've seen that. Or we've done that since the 60s, haven't we? Yeah, let's sit down and sing a song. But I agree with Roger that at that same time I might feel like, oh, God, I mean, we're stuck in a rut there. At the same time, it becomes a gesture of solidarity and a kind of, I like your term, flagging, Roger, of the space we're entering into and the kind of things we have to deal with, gird our loins to deal with, I suppose. And going back to the initial welcoming march on the 12th, like a good reserved intellectual for the first half or so of that demonstration, I wasn't chanting, but eventually I was chanting pretty loud. And, you know, because at first it was like, oh, the genre, here we go. What's the slogan are we doing now? But after a while,
well, you were chanting because you were getting actually pushed by the cops.
Yeah, I was. But, you know, it was all right. It was good to I was chanting before I was pushing. So
can I throw something into that that I think about, too, is, you know, in the way in which the four host nations in terms of the Olympics and that, right? And to recognize diversity of tactics isn't always a good thing. Because there's a diversity of tactics in terms of First Nations peoples around welcoming the Olympics versus being critical of, on the one hand. And then what I struggle with as well is the way that First Nations culture is used by the hegemony, everything from the Vancouver International Airport to to the Aboriginal buildings and so on, right, to the dancing at the opening ceremonies, and the way in which my racist relative saying, well, people all over the world are going to think it's just Indians here, right? Like that's the sort of redneck kind of attitude of where I come from, of people's attitude is around this. So there's that backlash on the one hand, and there's this really false way in which Native culture is and First Nations culture is used.
Yeah.
And that's why I was trying to say earlier out there, like, we are complicit too, because we can't just say it's only the hegemony imposing this onto First Nations dancers and so on. People and carvers and that, and people making sweaters and so on, right? There's a desire, totally understandable desire to make money.
All those faux couch and sweaters out there right now.
Yeah.
Well, some of the elders who were here for the evening news last week on one night, one of them brought up the First Nations presence at the opening ceremonies and said that she didn't recognize any of those people. So she said, meaning, you know, that's not who she thought of as First Nations.
Right.
You know, not on her radar. Not quite sure where those people were coming from.
Right.
Yeah. I'm thinking of Speech Act too, Roger, and maybe in just a second we can get you to give us a bit of your Speech Act protest genres essay. But again, that acknowledgement, you know, you brought up the situation of Premier Campbell almost saying that phrase. You know, it's like if you stand up and say, I declare these games open, or I declare you man and wife, or these kind of, or man and man, let's say, you know, these performative kind of statements. If the right person stands up and says, I acknowledge that we're on stolen native land or unceded, you know, Coast Salish land or something, it becomes quite a different speech act in a different context, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. But Roger, maybe you can lead us into that.
I'm going to try to sort of wade through some material on speech acts and in relation to slogans. And this actually ties in with something that Harjap pointed out earlier, that after the Friday and Saturday demos last week, was it last week? Yeah. In the Georgia Strait, there were articles that were basically saying that if the slogans of the Olympic resistance movement had not been framed within an anti-colonial framework, that there would be they would have had more support, more listeners, and
a bigger audience.
And I thought
that's a narrow issue.
Yeah, colonialism. Yeah, especially
issue.
In BC, right? You know, where there three land claims three signed treaties in British Columbia,
yeah,
I think, a tiny area on Vancouver Island.
Yeah, Tawasin.
Yeah, so, you know, so Harjap's point, I thought, was excellent. I mean, in a way, it's like, you know, we're the slogan "No Olympics on Stolen Native Land" is not representing a struggle, it's defining a struggle, and that's a really key point. Like, and I would actually raise this similar question in relation to critiques of the Black Bloc, the tactic of the Black Bloc, which is, you know, one of the articles we've seen that's getting a lot of circulation right now says, you know, we need a mass movement, not a Black Bloc, but it doesn't say what kind of a mass movement. Presumably we want a militant, engaged, and I would argue violent mass movement.
Yeah, why can't Black Bloc be part of the movement or the mass?
Yeah, it's the Black
Bloc attacked from the Black Bloc to a mass movement. I think that's the trick.
Yeah, and also the relationship between Black Blocs and the mass. But so these questions around slogans, I think this is one point at which I think poetics might be able to make direct interventions into political questions, insofar as, and at least in my interpretation, speech act theory and analysis of slogans would fall into the field of poetics. And so I have this piece that I written quite a long time ago, and to me feels a little bit dated, actually. There's a kind of an urgency in it that I just don't really feel anymore. One of the passages that I drew on here, and I'll read some of this stuff, and I'll try not to sort of hog the mic here for too long, but one of the passages that I read here, I was drawing on a conversation of by Deleuze and Guattari of a Lenin slogan in Mills Plateau in the chapter on pragmatics. And this is me kind of summarizing them. In his analysis of the sentence, "All power must be transferred to the Soviets," Lenin argued that this sentence used as a slogan was no longer useful because it ceased to relate to the historical conditions in which it was being used. In fact, Lenin argued that the slogan was meaningful only between February 27th and July 4th, 1917, which is an amazingly precise, you know, narrow shelf life for a slogan. But this idea that a slogan, you know, can be dated within a period of, say, like 5 or 6 months to specific dates within a specific year, and then after that period, the slogan no longer has any meaning. And he called this the period of our revolution. At this time, Lenin argued, it was still possible that power could be transferred from the provisional government to the Soviets peacefully. It was, as he said, a slogan for the peaceful development of the revolution, which, due to the rise of counter-revolutionary forces and allegiances, obviously later became absolutely impossible. His words. The slogan, "All power must be transferred to the Soviets," was no longer useful because the conditions in which it was being uttered had changed. From this, Lenin arrived at the conclusion, quote, that every particular slogan
must be deduced from the totality of specific features of a definite political situation.
That's Delusion Guattari, no?
That no, that's Lenin. Lenin. Okay, yeah, that's right. Lenin. So I'm kind of drawing on a discussion of Lenin's analysis of, it's kind of a treatment of Lenin as a speech act theorist, an early right. speech act theorist. Right. So that last passage is something I kind of want to throw out there in relation to slogans that we're hearing okay. used around the city right now. This last passage: every particular slogan must be deduced from the totality of specific features of a definite political situation.
We were talking about actually at the demo on the 12th, and Micah in particular, when people were saying this is what democracy looks like, and she's saying, you know, that, and she said, oh, I hate that one. I said, why? And she said, well, because that's you know, that's coming out of the WTO. The anti-globalization struggles in the 90s, right? And those were struggle, and I think it's really good, you know, in Seattle, in the battle in Seattle, you know, and I remember being there, and I think it's good because what they were, that was a good slogan at that time because they were arguing against non-democratic, anti-democratic forums like the WTO,
yeah,
right? Whereas now, and this is what Jody Dean talks about, now the problem is actually we don't think they're democratic enough, but we are in functioning democracies. And the U.S., even when it went to war, this is what Jody Dean argues in Democracy and Other Neoliberal Fantasies, it was a democracy. We don't agree with what it did, but it mm-hmm. was a democracy. Canada is it's a parliamentary democracy. It isn't the problem isn't that it's not a democracy. The problem is how the democracy is structured. It's not democratic. So it's a different yeah. sort of moment, I think. In some ways.
The problem there, in part, is definitions of democracy and what we're right. willing to accept as democracy.
Well, I think even more specifically, you could see it a couple of weeks earlier in the anti-proroguing rally, where yeah. there was the real kind of, you know, this idea that proroguing parliament is not democratic, and, you know, democracy requires debate. But then at that very rally, they were shutting down hecklers and so on, right? Like, they just want to have a nice, polite kind of, you know, very middle class sort of rally. Mm-hmm. So, and also, yeah, so I think that notion of democracy itself, not that we should abandon it, but I think it's become too much of this fetish of certain idea, certain parts of the left.
It's got a nice rhythm when you chant it, though, Clint.
It does.
What about get those animals off those horses?
That had a really nice rhythm, too. I like that one.
I had never heard that before.
That's an awesome one.
Yeah.
Well, it took having the police there on horses for people to start chanting, get those animals off those horses, I suppose.
Yeah.
We should come up with something about when they're on bikes. Those aren't our bikes. Or yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Whose bikes? Our bikes.
Yeah.
That's right. Nice. I like it.
Well, seriously, I guess though. So to come back then, the I agree with you 100% that the that slogan, this is what democracy looks like. Well, like when I hear that, that slogan and the other thing that I really wish people would stop saying at demos when the police, you know, inevitably show up is, you know, shame.
Yeah.
Shame, yeah. Shame. This shaming, it's like suddenly we've become, you know,
holier than thou,
Mormon. Who shames? Isn't it Quakers that shame you? Like they shun you. You know, when you.
Yeah.
Anyways,
well, Quakers.
It's got
Quakers
this.
Left.
It's,
come on.
Yeah, they're pretty lefty.
Yeah. But you know, so to come back to Harjab's comment too about you know, tailoring slogans in a way that they are interpretable and understandable to a hostile media.
Green.
Yeah, a hostile media, as if we can somehow just communicate neutrally through the media, communicate
right.
our ideas,
yeah.
And that we don't fundamentally lose control over the content of our struggles when we turn these, you know, we don't pay attention to a definite political situation, but instead we kind of anticipate a media apparatus that's going to control what we say, and instead of you know, defining our struggles, we speak, we think we can speak to it and just fill it with content. This is a delusion, terrible delusion.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Poor theory of media.
Yeah.
So then how does a tactic like Black Bloc play into this, where the media had very clear and specific and immediate reactions to the Black Bloc tactic?
I think the Black Bloc problematically is an attempt to overcome mediation.
Yeah.
I think that it's experientially and affectively it's closer to revenge than to slogans and demands, which I have some sympathy. I think revenge is a quality we could you know renew. Fanon thought we could, you know, that revenge was linked to reciprocity and to a process of humanizing of the colonizer, and I think there's some wisdom in that. But I think that Black Blocs to a certain extent understand that political speech is going to be recuperated by a hostile media apparatus, and rather than trying to tailor or craft a message in response to that recuperation, essentially adopts a strategy of indifference and just proceeds with a much more pragmatic target of inflicting economic damage without a message. And so, I mean, there is an attempt to overcome mediation there, which I think is not entirely successful, but,
We could circle back to our acknowledgement of stolen land, or specifically the comment from Georgia Strait, Roger, you're mentioning, questioning whether anchoring the united protests around the slogan "No Olympics on Stolen Native Land," whether that was a good move or not. Take the word Olympics out, and just, you know, maybe go back to our acknowledgement of stolen native land or unceded land. There's a certain, for the time being, anyhow, timelessness to that slogan. It's not anchored specifically. Once you get the word Olympic in there, maybe it is, but take that out, and that's one of those conditions that are ongoing, and that we can rally around something like that, because it's not able to be limited between March and 17th and July 1st, whatever the Lenin states
14, were. 1492.
Exactly, 1492 on ongoing.
To whenever colonization ends.
Yeah, exactly.
It unfortunately has a long shelf life.
Yeah, and why maybe we have to keep talking about these very kind of generalized terms, such about oppression and these sorts of things, exploitation, because they are ongoing issues. Rita?
Just there were a couple of things that came up earlier that I wish I had spoken to earlier, but sorry for the dead silence.
It's all right.
Oh, the dated slogan. Any dated slogans you want to throw out there?
Okay, thank you. The dated slogan. Yeah, because something about that slogan, if you unpack it, like, there's a key there, like, there's a kernel in terms of the property relations. Like, we were talking earlier in the room about property and land and owning land. But if you reverse it, the idea that people belong to the land rather than land belonging to people, like, all of that is in there if you kind of unpack
commons.
It, right? Like, it's there's something there that's really powerful.
I think so. I agree. It's a very broad critique potentially in there.
Because, you know, Annabelle Lyon, Yvonne, earlier was talking about this, how people relate to things spatially, and how much the Olympics works through a recolonization, through, or an intensification of colonization, through its spatial cutting up of the city, you know, all these areas you can't go walk through, people, you know, who live or work around False Creek, you know, like all these no-go zones.
The cutting up of the wetlands up by Horseshoe Bay, too.
Right. Like, yeah, for the building of it, right? And then what happens during the, you know, all the tents set up, you know, tents which are illegal. You can't have tents normally in the city, right? But now I don't just mean tent city. I mean, like, the massive tents that are there for all different venues, right? But and then the fencing everywhere. And so people wear badges. It's like this kind of a... Oh, sure, why not? It's kind of apartheid of a city, right? You know, in terms of, like, you have to have a pass, right? You wear the jacket and everything. You have to have
it's
your...
Like the camp.
Yeah. Bantustanization of Vancouver, you know. The green zone. We call it the blue zone, right? Mm-hmm. You know, there's an... So every color it would be...
Wouldn't it be a gold zone?
A red zone?
You know, right? You know, the green zone in terms of the center of Baghdad, which is a secure area, right? You know, that's the other green, right? Yeah. The green of money, right? Mm-hmm. But, yeah, so the way in which that spatialization, the no Olympics on stolen land, it's not just the fact that it's stolen. It's the fact that it then gets cut up and used up for, whether it's for profit or for the spectacle, for security, and so on.
Amazing that I don't know this for sure, but I think Canada Hockey House, they're calling it, is just a big tent, isn't it? I think it's one of these giant temporary tents, and they're calling it, and it costs something like $500 to go inside. You can stay there all day and drink all day, apparently, and maybe chum around with athletes and affluent people, but you're paying a ton of money to go inside a tent. How ironic is that in this current situation in Vancouver when we've got this tent city and the issue of homelessness? And I think the one thing that's been really eye-opening for me, as this 10 days or whatever it is, 12 days of Olympic resistance have been going on now, at least since the Olympics started. Obviously, the resistance was there before the Olympics got here. Anyhow, over these last 10, 12 days, I've been quite overwhelmed by the fact that the issue of homelessness has really risen to the top. And we've been talking about colonialism and stolen native land, but that issue of homelessness has really been come to the surface for me, and I think for many people, and we're seeing it almost every night here at Vivo during the evening news. So that how that's become kind of a lightning rod and a rallying cry, and a place where so many different concerns and diverse tactics are meeting around that one issue.
Have you guys talked in earlier shows about thanking the Black Bloc for their work? I mean,
no,
there was an article in the Georgia Strait.
I'll say thank you right now.
No, there was a Georgia Strait article where a professor at SFU, Mark Layer, I think, was quoted as saying how the other way of looking at it is, you know, they are doing the rest of the movement a favor, right? Because then the media can go to the good activists, you know, instead of the bad activists, that good cop, bad
they
cop.
They literally
favor,
used that
right?
language,
that was,
too.
That was Harsha who said that.
Was it Harsha?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Nice.
The article there.
Oh, yeah, you're right. It was Harsha.
Mark Lair says
anyway,
it.
Somebody
yeah.
else has said it. I'm
Mark
sure,
might say that.
But that makes sense that Harsha would say it too. But yeah, just like another way of looking at it is just, you know, that they're making news, whether it's taken favorably or not favorably. At least it's getting attention, right?
Yeah.
Whereas if you have a peaceful demo, and I love peaceful demos, don't get me wrong, but they're easy to ignore. You
exactly.
know? They're just. It's over.
And the media literally use the term acceptable protest.
Exactly.
There's acceptable kinds
it's
of protests.
And it's
exactly.
Yeah.
Like
and
the strike that isn't
versus the violence and that whole issue of calling window smashing
yeah.
violence, where, I mean, I read some story in the Vancouver Sun today where some 15, 20 people were arrested for public drunkenness and minor vandalism acts.
The red block.
45
the red
on
block,
the Friday night.
45 on the Friday night. So,
yeah.
So you know, there's it's not called violence when drunken hooligans wearing red jerseys knock things over because they're drunk, but it is when a few kids in black garb smash a window of a department store.
Yeah, I was reaching for mics here, but there's two ways of thinking about this. One, is it violent or is it not violent?
It's
not violent because it's not violent enough. There's much more. We're not talking Paris 2004. We're not talking the LA riots, right? I mean, this is
Athens 2008.
Yeah. We're not talking. You know, we're not talking World Trade Center. We're not talking what was going on that very morning in Afghanistan
mm-hmm.
with an escalation of attacking there. You know.
Yeah.
So I mean, we're not talking about that kind of violence. But then, if it is violence, you know, smashing windows, so on, right? You know, that's kind of violence. You know, then we have to talk about structural violence, you know, poverty. We have to talk about symbolic violence of language, you know, of calling, you know, protesters terrorists and so on.
Is it say Roger, green terrorism, go.
What?
Roger, green terrorism.
Oh, Roger. Oh, okay. You're referring to the in the U.S. after the Patriot Act was introduced. Shortly after the FBI was through congressional testimony was able to basically announce a second front to the war on terror, which was domestic and which was levied against radical environmentalists as part of the so-called Green Scare and Operation Backfire, where eco-terrorist was defined specifically as causing economic damage. And then
to a corporation.
That was pursued even further, the sort of linguistic violence and sort of decomposition of the environmental movement through the Animal Enterprise and Terrorism Act, where you could be sentenced to a 30-year terrorism enhancement for interfering with profitability.
Mm. Yeah.
Even if the companies aren't profitable.
Even
right?
if the company is not profitable, yeah.
Well, and the other thing, too, about just that violence riffing, and you know, this is something that Zizek talks about in his book, Violence, is that what do you call it, subjective violence, or you might even call it spectacular violence in the sense of protests or riots and so on, or crime or terrorism, that always seems to emerge against a period, against a backdrop of nonviolence. Whereas when we look at that backdrop of nonviolence, then we see the structural and the symbolic violence. It's there every day, all the time, mm-hmm. right? And so that eruption doesn't come out of nowhere.
And it's normalized.
Right, right. Yeah. exactly, mm-hmm. right? You know, it's poverty. Mm-hmm. It's, I mean, my kids in grade three, and this week, the superintendent for Vancouver School Board, I mean, they're already telling everyone with less than 5 years seniority, they're going to be giving them layoff notices.
Yeah.
And there's talking, and so this guy sends out this real glad-handing kind of three-page, overwritten, totally badly written, you know, aesthetically badly written memo to all the parents about, you know, preparing for the challenges, you know, of, and then saying, oh, we're cheering on the Olympics. Right, as though, you know, so I mean, that's violence, yeah. in terms mm-hmm. of the economics, right, you know, going on and closing schools, they're talking about, right there, right? So that's a kind of violence, and that's much more, going to affect many more people than some broken windows at HBC or a few banks.
Yeah,
right?
No kidding. Mm-hmm. Well, guys, we're deep into this show, and we're a long way from poetry, maybe.
No, we're still talking about poetics, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Should I read something briefly?
Yeah.
Just do it, Steve. And maybe then we'll play some music if we don't have any more discussion and we'll get out of here. But I started writing during the talks earlier during the evening news here at Vivo, and I started picking up or noticing two-word phrases some of the speakers were using, and I just started making lists of two-word phrases. Some of these are what people actually said in the room, but many of these are just what popped into my head, and I started riffing. So this is for all the folks at Vivo tonight. Social cleansing, brew pub, cauterized wound, mobile home, fast track, edge condition, leisure strip, natural beauty, home stretch, PowerPoint, urban planning, French dressing, street performance, bioproduction, boilerplate, view suite, sold out, brand name, protest genre, intellectual property, emerging area, punch out, private entrance, strip mall, social housing, crapshoot, broken promise, apple cart, developing permit, pro forma, profit margin, magic number, form fitting, product placement, authentic community, fast buck, blank canvas, open season, lifestyle, spacecraft, Shit Creek, tourist attraction, high density, wage labor, core values, immaterial labor, earthquake, pound cake, carpet bomb, sonic device, social spectacle, man-made, terra incognita, official sponsor, mood ring, tenderloin, choice cut, property value, tent city.
Footnote tenderloin?
Yes, indeed. Please footnote tenderloin.
I'm such a nerd to these things. But there's a tenderloin in San Francisco, and there's also one, yeah. I think, in Philadelphia. And those areas were historically poor areas,
yeah.
but they were also, at the turn of the century, like 100 years ago, there was a lot of corruption and bribery and so on. So the cops yeah. who worked there, their wives could afford to buy tenderloin because of the payoffs they would get from the saloon.
That's where the term comes from? Mm.
That's hilarious. The etymology I've heard.
Mm.
Wow. So it speaks directly to exploitation of those
yeah.
those depressed areas.
Yeah.
Isn't that interesting? Oh, the cops. Where would we be without the cops? Roger, maybe we could have some music and send our handful of listeners on their way.
Thank you, all of you, for listening. Oh, they've left.
We could see most of our listeners in the
there
other
might
room.
Be a couple
I think.
People out there. Okay, well, just to follow up on the conversation around tactics that we're having and revenge, I thought I would play a classic revenge tune, The Payback, Big Payback,
nice.
By James Brown.
I should say quickly, Roger, too, that we'll be back on tomorrow
yes.
night at 7 p.m.
Yeah, with Cecily Nicholson and
Nava Smolash.
Yeah, so join us again.
Hey! Got to pay back. Revenge. get back. Payback. Payback. Hit him!